As we open up Daniel 7, let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word to us that speaks so clearly about who you are. We pray now as we hear you speak that we might know you better. Amen. Daniel 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground, so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back, it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words of the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The 4 great beasts are 4 kings that will rise from the earth. But the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. Then I wanted to know the meaning of the 4th beast, which was different from all the others and most terrifying with its iron teeth and bronze claws, the beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. I also wanted to know about the 10 horns on its head and about the other horn that came up before which 3 of them fell, the horn that looked more imposing than the others and had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I watched, this horn was raging war against the holy people and defeating them, till the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favour of the holy people of the Most High. And the time came when they possessed the kingdom. He gave me this explanation. The fourth beast is a fourth kingdom that will appear on earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The ten horns are ten kings who will come from this kingdom. And then another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue three kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his holy people and try to change the set times and laws. The holy people will be delivered into his hands for a time, times and half a time. But the court will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself.
Well, good evening, everyone. A few years back, a mate of mine took me on a behind-the-scenes tour of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Phil was an engineer who worked on the bridge, and so without me having to pay hundreds of dollars for the privilege, he took me for a walk over the arch of the Harbour Bridge and into the Transport Management Centre. This was a room full of screens. It showed all the traffic from all these different angles on the bridge. I had a great big console in the room that they used to change the lights and the messages over the lanes and to move the actual lane barriers when it came time to adjust traffic flow. And it was just intriguing to have driven over the Harbour Bridge heaps of times, but then to be taken behind the scenes and to be able to see it from the perspective of the control room. And I'm telling you about it tonight because tonight's Bible passage also takes us behind the scenes. Not of the Sydney Harbour Bridge, but behind the scenes of life itself. It's as if this passage pulls back the curtains of heaven, and just like I got to see the bridge's control room, tonight we get to see God's control room and his perspective on life. And it's a fascinating perspective, and it's an enlightening perspective, because it's going to show us that the real influence and the real power and the real dominion in this world is not always where you think it is. And look, in showing us all this, tonight's passage is actually a very key chapter in the entire book of Daniel, which even the very first sentence of the chapter alerts us to. Verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. Okay, tonight's passage starts with a very deliberate date stamp to it. The first year of King Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Now that's significant because for the first time in the book, we have actually gone backwards in time. Because remember, the book opened at the time of the exile. Israel had been conquered by Babylon. Lots of the Israelites, like Daniel himself, are now living in exile in Babylon. But as the book has gone on, the Babylonian Empire has been conquered. It was defeated way back in chapter 5. And after chapter 5, Daniel has actually since been living under Persian rule. And as such, one of the lessons of the book so far has been drumming home the important fact that human kingdoms, like Babylon, they come and go, but God's always in control. He rescues, he saves, and his kingdom lasts forever. But now you see, here we are in chapter 7, and we've been knocked out of chronological order with the rest of the book so far. We've gone back in time to when Babylon was still in power. And what's more, our frame of reference is now different. Now we've got Daniel himself having dreams rather than him interpreting other people's dreams. And as you heard, as the chapter went on, it became more and more Daniel himself telling us the story. I, Daniel, did this. I, Daniel, felt this. That's really different to the rest of the book so far. And suddenly the style of writing is different, as tonight we have dived headfirst into what is often called apocalyptic writing. This is a style of writing that's full of symbols and all these weird and wonderful descriptions. And the net effect of all these changes, the change in chronology, the change in our frame of reference, the change to apocalyptic language, they're all combining to tell us that we have now entered a very different second half to the book. A second half in which the lessons of the first half, you know, those lessons about how God's kingdom lasts forever and how he rescues and he saves, those lessons from the first half are now going to be applied in the second half of the book to some very specific future events that Israel are about to go through. And tonight's chapter sets the whole thing up by taking us up into the control room of heaven itself. See, a couple of weeks ago, Sue and I visited Mount Kanopolis for the first time just out of Orange, which if you have ever been there yourself, you'll know that up on top of Mount Kanopolis there's a sign which tells you that if you were to draw a straight line between Sydney and Perth, Mount Kanopolis is, in fact, the highest point on that line, higher even than the Blue Mountains. And therefore, from the vantage point of Mount Kanopolis, you can look out in every direction and you can see way into the distance. And that's like tonight's chapter. From the vantage point of Daniel chapter 7, you can look out into the surrounding chapters of the book and you can look down at them and you can see exactly why they say what they say. It is a view from the control room of heaven. This is one of the majestic chapters of the Old Testament. Mind you, at first glance, it's also a bit of a confusing one because it starts with quite a confusing vision, doesn't it? Verse 2. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea." Now, as I mentioned before, these verses sort of plunge us headfirst into what is often called apocalyptic writing. This is a style of writing that's full of symbols and images and weird types of visions. The New Testament book of Revelation is written this same way. And it's a style of writing that can attract a lot of very strange ideas. Because what can happen is that people let their imagination run away with themselves, and so they dream up all these bizarre identifications about every single bit of detail. And so they often use chapters like this to justify wild conspiracy theories about how the world's going to end. That is not how you read a chapter like tonight's. You read a chapter like tonight's the way you watch television. And what I mean by that is that if you sit too close to a television screen, all you see is a jumble of pixels and all you get is a headache. When you watch TV, you need to sit far enough back to get the whole picture. That's the same with apocalyptic language. They are visions, and visions are meant to be looked at. So you step back and you visualize the overall thing. You take in the big picture and you read it like a picture book, not a puzzle book, where every little bit necessarily has to mean something. Now, of course, some bits do mean things, and there's a degree of identifying the symbols that are required, But here's the thing. The text will always tell us how much identification is needed. And in that sense, the vision that Daniel sees tonight is reasonably straightforward. As we just heard read, four strange beasts come out of a churning sea. There's a lion with wings. There's a bear with bones from a fresh kill still in its mouth. There's another predator, a leopard with wings. And then there's a fourth beast, which verse 7 says is terrifying and frightening and very powerful. This beast is not likened to any other sort of animal. In other words, this one is so terrible that there's nothing you can even compare it to. This one's your worst nightmare. It's chaotic, it's grotesque, and it's scary. But what happens next is that the Ancient of Days, God himself in blinding light, sets up his throne in front of these four beasts. And so the mood of the vision now changes to one of anticipation. We're expecting this massive conflict to erupt now between God and these terrible beasts. I continued to watch, verse 11. Because of the boastful words the horn was speaking, I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. See, it's amazing. You're expecting some sort of epic, cosmic, Star Wars type battle scene, and it's all over before you know it. There is no struggle. There is no contest. Despite how fierce and powerful the beasts seem, they are unceremoniously just swept aside. And then look at what happens. In my vision at night, I looked, verse 13, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. Are you stepping back and getting the big picture here? At first, it looks like all these beasts are really impressive and powerful, but in the end, they're not. In the end, it's one like a son of man. In other words, just a regular-looking bloke. He's the one who gets all the power. He's the one who gets all the glory and dominion. Wow, what does that mean? Well, for those of us who are New Testament Christians, we can probably take a pretty good guess at what it means. But let's just stick with Daniel a bit longer, because within the vision, Daniel is actually given a clarifying interpretation about what's going on. Verse 16. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the true meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The four great beasts are four kingdoms that will rise from the earth. Okay? Four beasts, four earthly kings or kingdoms. And immediately, this is where people get very excited because they want to identify which four kingdoms they might be. So, for example, I don't know, one's a lion. That could be the United Kingdom. They've got a lion on their royal coat of arms. Maybe one of the beasts is England. Hang on. Scots or St. College has a lion on its school crest. Maybe it's one of the beasts. You see how silly it can get very quickly? The bottom line is the text doesn't tell us who these precise four kingdoms it has in mind, which probably means at this stage of the book, it doesn't matter. See, next week in chapter 8, Daniel will be told very clearly which kingdoms his vision are about. But here in chapter 7, we're not told that because we don't need to know. Because the vision's not primarily about the beasts. Yes, they're in the vision, but they're not the point of the vision. The Son of Man is. And so even when Daniel presses for a bit more information, especially about that nasty fourth beast, he's still not given a precise answer as to what it refers to. Now, next week, when we get a precise interpretation about another vision, hindsight will probably tell us who it is, but at this point of the book, it doesn't matter, because the main player of this vision is the Son of Man. He's the one with all the power. He's the one with all the dominion. Who's he? That's the million-dollar question. And that's why Daniel is actually told who he is. Although there is a bit of a plot twist. Look at verse 17 again. The four great beasts are four kingdoms that will rise from the earth, but the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. The one like a Son of Man is a symbol in the vision for the saints of the Most High, according to verse 18, because they're the ones in the vision who receive God's kingdom and possess it forever. But here comes the plot twist. Look down at verse 27. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints, the people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. Now, I want you to notice the twist in that verse. The first half of it talks about saints and people of the Most High, plural, but then in the second half, it switches to his kingdom and obeying him in the singular. That's a little intriguing. What's that about? Is this Son of Man a symbol for a group of people, God's people? Or is it a reference to a single person? You can tell it's confusing because in some of our English Bibles, they even do a fiddle and they translate and change the second half of the verse to make it plural, trying to harmonise it, even though it's definitely the singular person that it's talking about. And the effect is that by the end of the vision, it's actually added a whole new layer of intrigue into who this Son of Man is. Sort of sounds like it's a symbol for God's people, but sort of sounds like it could be one person. What is it? The net effect is that the Son of Man actually became one of the great mystery men of the Old Testament. The Jews weren't sure what it was a reference to. And then Jesus of Nazareth strides into history. And he walks around Palestine. And the favourite way that Jesus has of referring to himself is the Son of Man. And you wonder, what does he mean by that? Is that just a term of humility, just saying that he's a regular bloke? Or is he, surely he's not saying he's the Son of Man? And then you hit Mark chapter 14, which is worth looking up. Mark chapter 14, because it then becomes crystal clear what Jesus is referring to. Mark chapter 14. I'm going to start reading from verse 60. Jesus is on trial for his life. Then the high priest stood up before Jesus and asked him, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," said Jesus. "And you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Now you cannot read that verse after just having read Daniel 7 and for it not to send a shiver down your spine. Picture it. Jesus is standing in front of Pilate and the Jewish heavies on trial for his life. It looks for all life as if Jesus is a loser. He would have cut a pretty pathetic figure, covered in blood, covered in bruises, arms probably bound together, people spitting on him, others insulting him. The full weight of the Roman Empire is about to come down on this guy's head. But with these words from Jesus, identifying himself as the Christ, the King of God, and the Son of Man, it's as if the curtain of heaven is rolled back and we get to look down on that scene from the perspective of the control tower. And now everything is completely reversed. Jesus is the one with all the power and dominion and authority in that room. He is the key, his is the kingdom that will last forever. Whereas the Roman Empire, like the beasts, will be swept away. And in history it was. Whereas Jesus willingly goes to the cross, both as our replacement and our representative, which is worth thinking about because they're slightly different, and it's an ingenious way that Jesus harmonises these ideas of the Son of Man being both a single person and a symbol for God's people. Because by being both, by dying in our place as our replacement and our representative, Jesus brings in a kingdom that will never be destroyed and that we get to be part of. And in that scene in Mark 14, the guy who looked like he was the victim is the victor. And the ones who look like they had all the power get brushed aside. Now, this is a very comforting reality check, because the things in this world can seem very impressive. You travel down to Sydney and you look at all the tall buildings and you think about the financial empires that they represent. And you travel to Canberra and you look at Parliament House and you drive around all the embassies. And they can seem very important and very permanent. And during the news last week, it was all about the political heavies at the G7 conference and what's going to happen with the stock market, with the US trade wars, and all of that sort of stuff we'll feel the repercussions of, sure. But from God's perspective, they're not the main game at all. Because they can seem so important, but come time, the US and China and Australia and every single G7 nation. Come time, every single financial empire, Google, Apple, BHP, come time, the public service, every small business, come time, the stock market, come time, it will all be brushed aside. And all that will be left will be the kingdom of Jesus. Which sort of changes how you look at things. Maybe those growth challenges that we've been promoting this year, and the cards are out there on the growth table, maybe they're more important than you think they are. Maybe some of the things that you've been doing during the week are actually less important than the world wants you to think. Which I'd love for it to be an encouragement for you tonight. Because sometimes you can get to the end of the week and you can feel as if you just haven't achieved a thing. You know, life is just so hectic sometimes, or sometimes life is just so uneventful and disappointing. And you can actually get to the end of the day and you can just feel a failure. But not necessarily. Because according to the view from the control tower, from God's perspective, you may have actually done something in that day that will last for all eternity. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Nobel Peace Prize winner from South Africa, he reckons that one of the most significant things that contributed to him becoming a Christian was when he was a little boy walking down the street with his mum and a white man was walking towards them. This was the days of apartheid, and so it was expected that a black would step into the gutter and allow a white to walk by on the footpath. Desmond Tutu records, however, that on this particular occasion, quote, "Before my mother and I could step off the sidewalk, this man stepped off the sidewalk. And as my mother and I passed, he tipped his hat in a gesture of respect to her. I was more than surprised at what had happened. And I asked my mother, why did the white man do that? My mother explained, he's an Anglican priest. He's a man of God. That's why he did it. When she told me that, I decided there and then that I wanted to be a man of God too." Isn't that interesting? A show of dignity and respect to another person. Something that possibly the guy who did it may not have even remembered doing later that night. And yet God used it to bring someone into the eternal kingdom of Jesus. That is part of the excitement when you start to see life from God's perspective. Who knows what God might do through you this week, even just in little things, as you seek to follow Jesus? Because please don't believe what this world wants to tell you about what things matter most. Soak in the view from the control tower. "Because before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority. He was given glory and sovereign power. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away." Be good to pray together.